This morning, we are going to start with tax court confirmations. We have three judges in front of us to recommend confirmation to the full Senate. Judge Joanne Turner, Judge Bradford De La Pena, and Judge Thomas Haluska. I hope I didn't mispronounce that too badly. Why don't the three of you come forward, please? And welcome to the Senate Tax Committee, judges. We are glad to see you here this morning. I think that maybe we will start by just if each of you would give us a few minutes about your background and some of your qualifications, just a short introduction of who you are and what your interests are of serving on the tax court would be helpful. And then we'll have a few general questions that you all can answer as you choose. So, Judge De La Pena.
Chairman Skoy, distinguished committee members, I'm Brad De La Pena, Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. Governor Dayton appointed me to the court in December of 2012. Because judges of the tax court vote to select a chief judge, I was appointed simply as a judge of the tax court and have no superior status as I sit before you today. I'd like to thank Governor Dayton for the opportunity to serve. I'd also like to thank the governor and the legislature for furnishing the court with a budget sufficient to ensure that it can properly serve the state's taxpayers. Indeed, sitting behind me are the first two law clerks that have ever assisted the court in its work. And with them is the tax court administrator today. And we're very thankful to have law clerks to assist us in managing trials and in doing the research to produce high-quality decisions. When I applied for this position in October of 2012, the court was a troubled institution. The Board of Judicial Standards was investigating its chief judge. It was widely perceived by litigants as dysfunctional or worse, and it was not effectively managing its caseload. Today, the court is a healthy and stable institution, efficiently managing its workload and issuing clear and consistent decisions. Much work remains to be done, and I ask for confirmation so that working with these exceptional colleagues seated beside me, I can contribute to that work. By way of background, I was a state public defender doing criminal appeals for the first 8 years of my career. I spent 7 years as an assistant Minnesota Attorney General, working in tax litigation and eventually managing the tax litigation division. And then I spent 5 years in criminal practice and representing taxpayers before the Commissioner of Revenue and the Tax Court. So I have some substantial experience coming into the tax court, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to serve. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chief Judge De La Pena. Judge Turner?
Thank you, Chairman Skoy. The late Vince Foster once told the graduates of the University of Arkansas, for those of you who haven't planned your life out yet, don't worry about that. It won't turn out that way in any event. And I'm a good example of that. My career, as you know from my resume, has taken many turns. I started in academia. I began to teach tax quite by accident. Fell in love with a course I had not enjoyed as an undergraduate. In 1990, we became financially able to send me to law school. I graduated from the University of Michigan debt-free, thanks to my husband, a luxury that allowed me my choice of careers after that. I spent a number of years in private practice, about a dozen years in private practice. I never did appear before the Minnesota Tax Court. We had a number of cases pending, but they all settled before we got there. But I did appear in one way or another in matters pending in 37 states and a number of federal courts. In 2005, I had the opportunity to become staff attorney at the Minnesota Supreme Court, and there had an insider's view to the deliberations of the tax court and its decisions. And then in 2012, as you know, Governor Dayton appointed me to the tax court. So although I serve on a court I never appeared before, I came to the court with a background in litigation and tax that was both broad and deep, and with a number of ideas for how to modernize the court, things that I had seen in practice and that had worked in courts in other states. And we've been able to apply a number of those ideas to the tax court. We've begun the process of modernizing the court, streamlining its procedures, improving the quality of its decisions, and ultimately restoring the faith of the public and of the practicing bar in the court itself. As the chief has indicated, we've made good progress on those goals, but we're not there yet. We have more work to do, including dealing with an antiquated case processing system. The practicing bar has told us that we can streamline our procedures even further, that they're willing to assume more responsibility in managing their own dockets, and we'll be working on that as well. Confirmation is an important part of that process because it is the symbol of our independence. The Minnesota Tax Court was one of the first tax courts in the country to be established independent of the Department of Revenue, and we are still one of the few in the country that is independent of the Department of Revenue. And again, our confirmation is an important public symbol of that, that we decide cases based on merit alone, not to please the Commissioner of Revenue, not to please the governor who appointed us, not to please the legislature who must ultimately confirm us. And that's why, again, we are here asking for confirmation today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Turner. Judge Haluska.
I'm afraid that I'm not as eloquent as my colleagues here, and I don't intend to take up any of your time in regards to.
And Judge, if you could just state your name so we can put it with the tape, that's helpful.
Sure. I'm Thomas Haluska, and my background is I'm a former assistant Anoka County attorney. I've practiced with the county attorney's office since 1979. And I covered a multitude of areas, mostly litigation, and for the last 25 years of my time with the county attorney's office, I did real estate tax appeals and appeared before the Minnesota Tax Court numerous times as a litigant in trial and motions and hearings of various types, as well as in all of the courts of the state of Minnesota. Before the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, as well as Federal District Court, and I've practiced in bankruptcy court here in the state of Minnesota as well as in the state of Wisconsin, where representing Anoka County. So my background, I think, is uniquely suited to my role as a judge with the Minnesota Tax Court. And I think that my background complements the background of my colleagues here who have realistically done the brunt of the work of cleaning up any of the areas of the tax court that really needed to be cleaned up. And I'm looking forward to serving as a judge of the Minnesota Tax Court, and I'm here asking for your confirmation. As part of that, I would really like to thank Governor Dayton for his confidence in me and recommending me for the tax court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And all three of you have mentioned the work that you are engaged in improving the court. Timeliness, I am assuming, of rulings, probably consistency of rulings. And you also mentioned the two clerks that were hired, and I don't know if you brought up the software, but could you be a little more specific about the clerks, the software, the timeliness of rulings, and then also do you have other areas that you think that might be the legislature to be helpful in you improving the tax court?
Let's go ahead.
Judge Turner.
We have worked hard to shorten our dockets. I'll tell you quite frankly that the work is made more difficult by the fact that the parties that appear before us sometimes actively collaborate in thwarting our efforts. There is, because of the statutory scheme, there's actually not much incentive for cases to move quickly through the tax court. In regular commercial and civil litigation, there is one party who's trying to get the case to trial because it's the only way they can see themselves as better off. Because of the statutory scheme in tax court, particularly in property tax cases, if you petition your property tax cases in 1 year, you pay your first half installment, the May installment. But for as long as the case is pending, you only have to pay half of the October installment. And that half, that's a quarter of your taxes for that year, and that never has to be paid until the case is resolved. And you get that benefit for a filing fee of about $300. So depending on how big the installment is and what you think you can do with the money in the meantime, there's very little incentive for the plaintiff, for the petitioner to take the case to trial. You'd think the county would be pushing, but in many cases, the counties would have to hire an outside appraiser in order to bring the case to trial, and that requires, that's an outlay of cash, a substantial outlay of cash. Nevertheless, we are making good progress in moving cases along sheerly by order. We used to allow the parties to postpone trial almost indefinitely. We no longer allow that to happen, and we're trying to move to a system in which the parties will expect that the case will be tried in about 16 months of the issuance of the first scheduling order. And that's about the best we think we can do. We're not asking that the statute be changed. We just have to deal with the cards that have been laid before us. In terms of shortening time to issue decisions, we're under statutory mandate to issue a decision within 3 months of the case being submitted, and we comply with that. We're trying to get things out early. And here again, having access to computerized legal research, having access to Westlaw, having two law clerks to help us made a world of difference, a world of difference. We are on top of our dockets. We're managing them actively under those constraints. Senator Scoy.
And I'll
Judge
address
Delapini.
Chairman Scoy, I'll address the case management system. We have an electronic case management system that was created in about 1999. And it is rather antiquated at this point, given the massive progress in technology. We actually have a computer tech who had to sort of create an old computer within a new computer in order just to run it. And at some point, what we fear is that the system will take a dive and we won't be able to get it running again. And so we've taken all the necessary backup measures and so forth, but even the producer of the technology doesn't support it anymore. That is the software technology. And so we have some money. We're seeking some more money this year for an updated system that we would be able to run independently, but that would also interact easily with the judicial case management system known as MNSIS. And we could offer you more details about that, but essentially what we're looking to purchase is the underlying software called Odyssey that is essentially MNSIS. So we would have a completely compatible system that could speak with MNSIS. Then the judicial branch would have no concerns about sharing the information because you'd have two separate systems, but they'd speak with one another.
Thank you. And just briefly, do you feel that the majority of the cases you're meeting the timeline that you have to issue the ruling, the 3-month timeline? How is that done?
We're meeting it, Chairman Scoy, in all of the cases in the last 14 months, and I think that will not be a problem. What we're really attempting to do, and Judge Turner alluded to this, is to clear the parking lot. If there's no incentive in the parties to move the docket, what we're doing is commanding them to move the docket. And so it's really the front-end side. Once a case is submitted, we have 90 days. I failed once. to issue within the three-month period because I miscounted my deadline. But that was not a problem with capacity. It was simply a math error. But we are moving the cases, certainly at the back end, and what we're going to do is accelerate the front end as well.
Any questions, members? Perhaps at this time we should offer thanks to the clerks and the administrator that are sitting behind you. We understand as legislators that a lot of time the staff is doing a majority or a lot of the work. And so I'll offer my thanks to you for the work you're doing for these judges, because we understand that their success is a lot of time depending upon how your work is going. So anything that any of you would like to add? Any other questions, members? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Turner, I was just curious what instrument you play in the Wayzata Symphony Orchestra.
I play a number of instruments, but in the WSO, I play harp. I specialize in large instruments that are heavy and difficult to move.
It's like
in my next
challenge.
Life, it'll be the piccolo, let me tell you.
Thanks.
Seeing nothing else, I'm going to need three motions, and Senator Marty will move that Judge De La Pena be recommended the confirmation of judge to the tax court. Any questions, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Judge, your recommendation is sent to the Senate. Senator Eaton would move that Judge Turner. Senator Eaton moves to recommend the confirmation of Judge Turner to the tax court. Questions, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Judge Turner, your confirmation is set to the Senate floor. And Senator Reinertz would move to recommend the confirmation of Judge Haluska to the tax court. Questions, members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Judges, you are sent to the floor for confirmation. Thank you all very much, and
thank
good
you.
Luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do I need to go up there?
I was curious.
Me too. Members, we're going to do the department technical and policy, miscellaneous policy bill today. I think I'll stay here and have the department present. Say that again.
Mr. Chair, my apologies if I took your seat.
No, that's fine. I'll stay here. So we will start with Senate File 1970, and the department's here to walk us through the miscellaneous and policy bill. And Ms. Starr, are you going to start?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Starr, Senior Manager for Tax Policy at the Department of Revenue. I'm joined here today with Kyle Gustafson, our property tax attorney, and Margaret Reisdorf, our sales tax attorney, to walk you through the department's policy and technical bill. We'll start with Senate File 1970. Oh, and I want to make sure to start and thank Chair Skoy on hearing these bills today and on staff for helping us prepare these bills over the last few months. We appreciate all of your input. I'm starting with Article 1 of Senate File 1970. This is our property tax article, and Mr. Gustafson will begin.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members. Again, my name is Kyle Gustafson with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Starting with Article 1 of the department's policy bill, Section 1 changes the reporting deadline from June 15th to June 30th for the department to provide the Department of Education with school districts' adjusted net tax capacities. The reason for this change is
Could you pull the mic in a little bit, please?
Certainly. The reason for this change is that the department does not quite have final audited abstract data by June 15th, and so what happens under the current law is the department provides preliminary information to the Department of Education by June 15th and then supplements it throughout the rest of June as it receives the final data. The department has talked with the Department of Education on this, and they are supportive of the change. Next, in Section 2, this allows local boards of appeal and equalization to hold their local boards at a central location within a county or at the office of the county clerk. Current statute requires that those meetings be held at the city clerk or the county clerk's office. In larger counties, a central location may be more convenient and therefore more accessible for taxpayers in those counties to attend a local board meeting. And then Section 3 adjusts the deadline for local boards to provide proof of compliance and then for the training requirements that a member on a local board has met all the training requirements to be on that board. It also changes the deadline for local boards whose powers are transferred to the county to file the required resolutions and proofs of compliance for training in order to have the local board or the local boards have their power restored. These changes for both these would change the deadlines from December 1st to February 15th, and these deadlines would then line up with the reporting deadline for an assessor to decide the format and the time and place for either a local board of appeals an equalization meeting or an open book review of property tax valuation appeals. And that concludes Article 1. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson.
Article 2 is our miscellaneous article. Section 1 allows the commissioner to make personal liability assessments for business taxes within 1 year of a final administrative or judicial determination of the underlying business tax. Current law limits the commissioner to make these assessments within the prescribed period of of assessing the underlying business tax or within 1 year after the date of an order assessing the underlying tax, whichever expires later. What this means is that in some cases, personal liability assessments are made before the amount of the underlying business tax is finally determined, which can be very frustrating for business owners to then be defending both personal liability and the amount of the underlying tax at the same time. We'd like to relieve that burden. Section 2 changes the due date of the fourth quarter withholding tax return from February 28th to January 31st or February 10th if all withholding deposits for the quarter have been timely made. This coincides with the fourth quarter due date for federal purposes. And because of the matching of the due dates, there's no new burden to taxpayers. Section 2 also relieves seasonal employers from having to file a withholding tax return for periods of unanticipated inactivity. And that concludes our policy bill.
And Ms. Starr, there's an amendment I have here, the A1 amendment, and it's do you have a copy of it? Let's pass the A1 amendment out. It's on page 2, line 29, where they're making changes to the meeting requirement. And there is a stricken shall, and then you're allowing them to meet at a central location. I think we should reinstate the shall and delete the may, so that they're required to hold the meeting, but we'll give them the flexibility as to location.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, the reason the department has provided the shall in the second paragraph is because in the first paragraph of subdivision 1, starting at the end of line 2.24 and then continuing on to 2.25, that still provides a mandate that there be the meeting, the local board meeting. So the first paragraph requires the meeting, and then the second paragraph provides the option of where the meeting is held.
Kind of a moot point. Either.
Mr. Silva?
Mr. Chair, my only comment would be I think striking shall and turning may may be misinterpreted, perhaps be interpreted as permissive language. I would recommend that the amendment go forward and that we retain the word shall, but certainly that would be up to the determination of the chair.
And members, I see no reason not to reinsert the shall, and then it is clear that they shall meet. So I'll move the A. Would Senator Bach move the A1 amendment? Any further discussion, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Anything else? Any questions, members? So we will lay Senate File 1970 as amended over for possible inclusion. All those in favor say, I'm just laying it over. No, we don't need to vote. Okay. Thank you. Senate File 1970 is laid over. Apologize for that. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chair, do we have, I'm sorry, why don't you get the bill in front of us, and then I have something in the body of the bill that I can't stay to discuss. If we could take up a provision I'm concerned about first, okay, so that I can meet my other commitment.
And so we will now move to Senate File number 2091. The Department Technical Bill. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed there's a repealer in Article 2, Section 45. On the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. There is a formula in law that prior to 2011 determined what the per acre payment for land enrolled in SFIA would be. And it's pretty complicated. I can't explain it, but it has something to do with the value of the timber, the value of the land, and then they arrive at a dollar and cents per acre that should be the incentive. And in 2011, the legislature made a decision to actually reduce the payment and cap it at $7 and ignore the formula. I think there's a much larger issue around SFIA, considering the legislative auditor's report, that this legislature needs to deal with. I think they raised clearly some deficiencies in the program. I also think in a short session, this committee probably doesn't have the time to deal with that, but I'm a little reluctant to just repeal the old formula, even though we're not using it, until we've actually had an opportunity for the industry, the Minnesota Forestry Association, and probably have the auditor come in. And could be there was nothing wrong with the old formula or a small tweak in it, and I just hate to have to go to the trouble to have to kind of create that whole formula. I don't see, as long as we're not using it right now, I don't see any problem with it staying in law so we can have a better, thorough discussion, have some public testimony on the proposal next year when we try to take up a larger reform package of SFIA. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't have time to stay. I have another commitment, but I really would like the committee to consider deleting that repealer, Article 2, Section 45.
And, Ms. Starr, do you have a reaction to that? Because my feelings with regard to SFIA is the only actions I thought the legislature was going to do with regard to that program this year was to take a look at if there were parcels of land that might be getting more payment than they were paying in property tax, and then also just taking a little look at the requirement for the easement on some of the smaller parcels. But I wasn't contemplating repealing provisions on it. So do you have thoughts on this?
Mr. Chair, my understanding, and Mr. Gustafson can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the provisions in our technical bill are simply taking out the obsolete calculation of the incentive payment, and it's not intended to be any substantive change to current law. I understand Senator Bach's concern, but I'm just reporting, I guess, on what's in the technical bill and what was intended.
I think, members, Senator Bach will move to remove the new language, Article 2, Section 45. Any questions?
My motion.
Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. That amendment's adopted.
Thank you.
And then there is also an amendment for this provision, and I'm searching for it here. Okay, you're right. Well, it could have been an author's amendment. Well, Senator Rest is not here. And Senator Rest is not here. She is the chief author, but I am a second author, so I will work with the department and present the technical bill. And let's walk through it, and then we'll deal with the amendment. So, Ms. Starr.
Beginning with Article 1, which is our income taxes article, Sections 1 and 2 remove obsolete modifications for intangible drilling costs incurred in taxable years prior to 1987. Section 3 removes a phrase that was made obsolete by a prior year legislative changes to the corporate franchise tax sales apportionment factor. That concludes Article 1, and Mr. Gustafson will take Article 2.
Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, starting with Sections 1 through 3 and then numerous other sections throughout Article 2, if the committee would like, I could list each one, but these are provided in the first section of our summary. These are provisions that replace the term class rate with classification rate to provide consistency and uniformity throughout the statutes, and additionally, classification rate is the preferred term in the assessment community. Secondly, these provisions simplify the statutes by inserting the actual classification rates of certain types of property rather than providing cross-references to other the classification rates of other types of property. For example, current law, 1D property, which is seasonal farm employee housing, simply provides a cross-reference that has the same classification rate as 1A property. These provisions would instead insert the actual classification rates for 1D property and state what those are, making the statutes more accessible to a taxpayer who's reading those statutes. Next, sections 4, 6, 8, and 26 through 28 provide the clarification about the authority of local assessors to make clerical corrections to personal as well as real property valuations, and also allows the Commissioner of Revenue to make clerical corrections to state assessed values up until December 31st of an assessment year. So these would be for railroad, utility, and wind energy production tax values if there's a minor clerical error such as transposed numbers or something like that. Section 12 provides some clarification to the provisions related to the valuation of land with the conservation easement. Specifically, this removes the reference to 84.64 subdivision 2, which is one definition of a conservation easement, but this brings the statute in line with the legislative intent and clarifies that it would apply to all conservation easements. Furthermore, the proposed changes would amend the changes from last year to clarify that the changes last year would only apply to conservation easements that went into effect after the enactment of those changes last year.
And clarify the date change again. So what you're telling us is that you're clarifying that the changes that were made in 2013 are prospective only.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, members. The effective date was May 23rd, 2013, so those changes from last session would not have any effect on conservation easements that were in place at that time.
Okay. Those are questions.
Yep.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Chair Skoy. And you've answered that. I know I have a meeting on this at home tomorrow. There's not a lot of land in Duluth with conservation easements on it, but there are people that care about that issue. So that's helpful because I think it's the potential backward-looking that people are concerned about. So I think this clarification is actually going to answer that question. Thank you.
Continue, Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next,
maybe while we're on this section, I do have an. No, that's not on this section. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 32 addresses the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act and provides language that specifically states that land classified as 2C managed forest lands cannot be enrolled in the SFIA program. There is similar language in the statutes dealing with the 2C managed forest land, providing that those lands are not eligible for the SFIA program. This simply provides parallel language in the SFIA statute. Next, in Section 33, these provisions, or this change, corrects an internal reference. It corrects a reference which currently cross-references the supplemental amortization aid provisions in that statute. Supplemental amortization aid was repealed last session, so instead this corrects that to cross-reference now the amortization aid. Section 43 provides a correction to the calculation for wildlife management land payments or PILT payments for those lands, and this change would bring in line the calculation for those payments to be consistent with the calculation that's used for acquired natural resources land and transportation wetlands. Section 44 would change or make a clarification that a township with qualifying PILT lands would receive their proportional share of a county's PILT payments that are derived from those lands in that township. And that concludes.
And members, I think at this point, while we're on this PILT section, an issue has arose with regard to page 51, line 34, it's section 8. The DNR currently has needs the a change to this to allow them to make that payment. And so I would offer the A3 amendment at this time.
It's been passed out.
It's been passed out. And so, members, this simply references the rule to allow the DNR so that they can make this payment that is to be made on these ConCon lands. And Ms. Starr, Mr. Gustafson, do you have the amendment?
Mr. Chair, we have the amendment, and my apologies. We just haven't had a chance to look at it, but you've talked to the DNR.
The DNR.
That's good to know. Thank you.
Brought this to us. So I think we'll put this on, and if it's an issue, we'll still have opportunities to deal with this. So, Senator Marty? Senator Marty, move the A3 amendment. Any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Thank you. Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, and with the removal of the repealer section, that brings us to Article 3, our sales and use taxes article. Ms. Reisdorf will present.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Reisdorf. I work for the Minnesota Department of Revenue and work in the sales tax division. Section 1 relates to a provision, legislation enacted last session that provides special rules for the collection and remittance of 911 and telecommunications access fees for prepaid wireless phones and minutes. And in that legislation, we make a change in Section 1 so that a reasonable fee that the Commissioner of Revenue can collect for collecting and remitting these fees, it provides an annual appropriation for those amounts. Section 2 relates to a technical provision added last session that relates to contributions in aid of construction. Last session, Section 4, our retail sales statutes were amended to make clear that contributions in aid of construction do not constitute a retail sale. At that time, the effective date of that provision stated for all sales and purchases after June 30th. Because the department has, it's always been our position that that was simply a technical change, this Section 2's amendment makes the effective date of that provision the day following enactment, as opposed to June 30th. Section 3 relates to two different repealers of obsolete rules. The first relates to the sourcing of florist sales. In 2011, the legislature amended our sourcing statutes, sales tax sourcing statutes, with the addition of Subdivision 9. Subdivision 9 essentially provides all the information for sourcing that was provided in the rule, so this rule language is obsolete and is no longer needed. The second repealer deals with an obsolete rule that deals with aircraft registration. Aircraft registration is now done through the Department of Transportation, and so these rules for our administration are also no longer needed. And that concludes Article 3.
Article 4 is our miscellaneous article. Section 1 makes it clear that the abatement procedures in Minnesota statutes apply to all of the items that the commissioner may abate, which includes late file and late payment penalties, related interest, and the additional tax charge. And finally, Section 2 clarifies that dyed biodiesel and dyed biodiesel blends are included in the definition of dyed fuel. And that completes the testimony on Senate File 2091.
Any questions, members?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
And we will lay Senate File 2091 over for possible inclusion. Senate File 2091 is laid over. Anything else, members? Okay. For Tuesday of next week, the division will meet. We will be addressing the division will be working on the issue with regard to local governments and some of the joint powers and other form of local governments with regard to the sales tax exemption. Wednesday of next week, the division will meet and we'll be hearing member bills. And then Thursday, the committee will meet and we will be dealing with TIF provisions and other member bills if we have time. TIF provisions on Thursday. Meeting members, thank you very much. Committee's adjourned.